Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, where geopolitics and environmentalism meet, we look at three stories at the intersection between defence and climate security. They are the sanctions loophole allowing EU countries to import Russian LNG, the climate knowledge gap left by the war in Ukraine, and the EU's largest rare earth magnet factory, right on Estonia's Russian border.
This plant is the most competitive plant in magnet production, rare earth magnet production of its kind, and it's starting where Europe starts.
That's all coming up here on Inside Europe.
My message to the COP would be, those of you who were using the endless resources of oil and gas to power the authoritarian regimes, you governments must now step in and enable the energy transition in other countries, not just try to put this burden onto these small countries.
That's the voice of the Ukrainian environmentalist Svetlana Romanko. The first conversation that I ever had with Svetlana was in February 2022, just days after Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Already back then, Svetlana's message was clear. Fossil fuels were both the engine of the climate crisis and the engine of Russia's war machine. If the EU wanted to help Ukraine, then it must end its addiction to cheap Russian oil and gas. I reminded Svetlana Romanko of our first conversation when we spoke earlier this week.
Yes, thanks so much for really recalling these days, which were both absolutely horrific, but also full of hope, because we were so hopeful that European Union and other G7 countries, they will all impose immediate bans. But we learned how to wait.
I can hear the resignation in your voice, Svetlana, and that is because 4 years on, a critical loophole in Western sanctions remains, and that is LNG, or liquefied natural gas. So this week, a new report from your organisation, Raz On We Stand, revealed that the European Union remains the biggest buyer of Russian LNG, with over two-thirds of cargo from the Yamal LNG project going to European countries.
EU is leading this shameful list of those who still love Russian LNG very much. But I wanted also to pay special attention to Germany, because I remember very well in April 2022 when we visited the former Chancellor's office and we visited Bundestag, and they all were saying, no, we can't do that, because German economy needs gas and we are up for supporting the German economy and we can't do that.
Germany did, of course, manage to stop direct imports of Russian gas via the Nord Stream pipelines and also moved to stop Russian shipments of LNG arriving via German terminals. However, Svetlana, your research shows that the state-owned company SEFA, formerly known as Gazprom Germany, a name changed there in 2022 to dissociate it from the Russian parent company, SEFA is still one of Europe's most significant importers of Russian LNG, which arrives via Belgium.
This German state fossil fuel SEFA is a very exempt case, because it is owned by state and it continues to import Arctic Russian LNG under long-term contracts. We also need to mention a significant detail that new calls this week by German's economy ministry call for SEFA to end its long-term contract. But actually there should be no more discussion, and they should declare a force majeure and stop SEFA from sending billions to Kremlin.
So the German perspective here would be that German industry needs cheap gas, cheap LNG in order to be able to stay competitive, and that without it, the economy would be weakened, and that, of course, would then play into Russia's hands. But I wonder how that economic pragmatism sounds to Ukrainian ears.
So from the 1st January of this year until 20th of September, the import of LNG for Germany amounted for 186 million euros. That would fund over 5,700 offshore head jobs. And just to pause here and remind that what Russia does, they every night attack Ukrainian cities, Dnipro, Kharkiv, Sumy, Chernihiv, and also Kyiv and other, many other cities with drones. And the largest ever fixed attack was 700 of drones. And we can see that 5,700, how many terrible nights and how many lives it could cost just for this relatively small amount of contracted LNG. And I just want to bring one example that shocked me yesterday. I've been to some event where there were lots of local communities, Ukrainian local communities, and there was a person from Chernihiv, which is very close to Ukraine's eastern border with Russia. And what they told me is that they don't have electricity for the 3 days already. Those workers wake up at 3 a.m. and they walk through the completely dark streets to use this 1 hour or 30 minutes of power supply that is going to be supplied, because every other time of the day it's been undercut because Russia destroyed too much energy infrastructure and there is no power. There are complete darkness, blackout, and they cook lunch for these small children who will join the children garden in the morning, sitting with no gas, no heat, but their parents have to work.
Under the RePowerEU roadmap, the EU aims to end all imports of Russian LNG by the end of 2027, beginning of 2028. But there is a shorter timeline laid out in the 19th sanctions package. And the accelerated timeline, that is key to your report's recommendations.
How to close the loopholes immediately. First, short the timelines. And also dealing with TotalEnergies and also SEFE and Flixus and the like is essential for the governments. It's such a test for not just supporting Ukraine, but building the foundation of a true post-fossil security across Europe. Actually, we've been really delighted to hear the strong language of Chancellor Merz during the Ukraine Rebuilding Conference. But now it's the time to say a final word, which is about ending long-term contracts and declaring a force majeure. And lastly, in the fourth year of the war, European Union still doesn't have a dedicated authority agency that would actually investigate the loopholes and put the law enforcement measures on those who are violating the laws. The huge elephant in the room, which is a very scary elephant, very big one, but no one is really talking about it in the media and everywhere, it's that Yamal LNG is not yet sanctioned.
Svitlana Romanko is a Ukrainian environmentalist and founder of the campaign organization Razum We Stand. We will be linking to Razum's report in the show notes. Our next story is less about the intersection of geopolitics and environmentalism and more about what happens when the two clash. International collaboration between scientists is key to better understanding climate change. And Russia, with its boreal forest, permafrost and Arctic ice, is a crucial part of that puzzle. But, as Levi Bridges reports, Russia's war in Ukraine is hindering research and opening up a dangerous knowledge gap.
Earlier this year, a Russian gardener outside Moscow posted a video on YouTube about how to plant tomatoes. She mixes a little fertilizer in the soil, then crunches up some eggshells for added nutrients. Plant the seeds and voila, soon they'll become big, juicy tomatoes. But over WhatsApp, she tells me climate change is making it more difficult to garden in Russia. We're not giving her name because Russians can receive retaliation from the authorities just for talking with Western journalists, especially about something as politically charged as climate change. She says a warm winter is actually not great for gardening. Her tulips and narcissus didn't bloom well this year. The apples and pear trees didn't do so great either. She says gardeners all over Russia had the same problem. And we're seeing a lot more pests and blights now in Russia than in the past, she says. Last January was the warmest on record. In Moscow, people filmed videos of birds chirping in the dead of winter. Russia is home to what have historically been some of the coldest places on Earth. In a typical winter up near the Arctic Circle, it can get so cold that temperatures actually affect the speed of sound. Check out this recording of a man opening a window in the Russian region of Yakutia. That's the sound of very cold air, around negative 50 Celsius. Close the window, and it stops. But this part of Russia is now one of the fastest warming places on Earth. Scientists predict the Arctic will warm more than 3 times the global average. Yuri Zhigusov is a sociologist in Yakutsk, Russia, the world's coldest city, at least for now. He says many people there are concerned. Warmer weather is destroying roads and infrastructure, but others see an opportunity. Russia controls the Northeast Passage through the Arctic Ocean, he says. Less ice and snow, that'll open up all kinds of economic opportunities in Russia's Arctic, from new shipping routes to mining and oil drilling. Russia contains the majority of the Earth's permafrost, which essentially is frozen ground. As the climate warms, permafrost thaws and releases climate-changing carbon and methane. Martin van Hardenbroek is an environmental scientist in the Netherlands who's worked extensively in Russia.
Russia has a potentially huge impact on the climate because of the possible release of carbon from permafrost.
Scientists estimate that thawing permafrost could release as much carbon into the atmosphere as all cumulative emissions from the U.S. combined. Van Hardenbroek researches the history of climate change. He's paddled out into various lakes in remote parts of Siberia, filming with colleagues as they take samples of sediment left over from thousands of years ago. Analyzing past climate change events can help researchers understand how our planet is currently changing. Van Hardenbroek collaborated with Russian scientists on his expeditions, but that work came to a screeching halt in 2022 when Russia invaded Ukraine. Many European institutions pulled funding for research in Russia and forbid researchers like Van Hardenbroek from traveling to Siberia.
Of course, this is nothing compared with what's happening in Ukraine when bombs and rockets are dropping in Kiev on a daily basis. But of course, it's a very sad thing for the world where these positive collaborations, that's not happening anymore.
Other European researchers are trying to pinpoint how our climate will change in the future. Tore Furevik is the director of the Nansen Environmental and Remote Sensing Center in Norway. His institution studies how the Arctic Ocean is currently warming. But they had to stop doing marine and climate research with Russian colleagues because of European sanctions imposed after Moscow's invasion.
We could no longer send money from Europe to Russia, so this collaboration more or less stopped overnight.
They can't get oceanic data from Russia anymore either. Fordovic says they can still get a pretty good read on how oceans are warming using satellite data in combination with improved climate models and advancements in AI. But still, not having data from large parts of the Arctic is far from ideal.
So you're losing parts of the picture. You can only estimate what's going on, and you have much less information and less knowledge.
Furevik says European scientists are now worried about the United States, where the Trump administration is slashing funding for climate research. If that trend continues, there could soon be even less data to help researchers understand how our climate is changing. Levi Bridges, DW.
By the way, if you are looking for climate change information that's disappeared from US government websites recently, then there is a tool called the Federal Environmental Web Tracker that you might find helpful. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
Still the fact remains, you deny it ever happened, deny it ever will, deny it ever happened, but it keeps on happening still.
Magnets made from rare earth metals are essential components in everything from electric vehicles to wind turbines. But there's a problem. Currently, around 90% of rare earth magnets are produced in China. It's a dependency that the EU is determined to reduce in the coming decade. Key to that ambition is a newly opened magnet factory in Narva, Estonia, a landmark project for the EU's green and industrial policies. The location, right on the Russian border, is both a geopolitical statement and a gamble, as Josep Fek reports.
Europe's largest rare earth magnet factory is up and running after less than 500 days of construction. The Canadian company Neo Performance Materials chose Narva, the EU's easternmost city with a border crossing point to Russia, often described as NATO's frontline, for the facility. Here's the company's vice president Vasileios Tsianos shortly after the inauguration.
This plant is the most competitive plant in magnet production, rare earth magnet production of its kind. And it's starting where Europe starts.
Narva factory produces rare earth magnets, but is also a rarity in Europe itself, according to EU Commission official Maive Rute. The Commission and Estonian government have backed the project with 14.5 million euros. It was the first project to receive a funding decision from the Just Transition Fund.
It's one of the very few places in Europe, really very, very few places in Europe, where we have rare earth processing. We can really count them on two hands' fingers, so the opportunities in Europe on rare earth are very, very limited.
Merely a river and a bridge separate the Estonian city of Narva from Russia. That separation is visible due to the ever-long border crossing queue next to the bridge on the main square of Narva. This is one of the few places where people can directly enter Russia. Supporting the industry here isn't just of economic interest. It's also about countering geopolitical vulnerabilities and strengthening social cohesion through investment. Around 90% of Narva's residents speak Russian as their first language. And they are frequent targets of disinformation campaigns from across the border.
The Just Transition Fund of the European Union aims to help transition jobs that are being lost in carbon-intensive and carbon-emitting industries into industries that are in the supply chains of net zero or support the net zero transition. And the Ida Virumaa region and Narva is one of those regions where there are about 6,000 folks, good folks in unemployment because of the phasing out of shale oil production gradually.
In other words, Narva is a perfect fit for the EU's Just Transition criteria, which aims to retrain fossil fuel workers for the industries of the future. And rare earth magnets are exactly that, as EU Commission's Rute explains.
For all the electrical appliances or big equipment, technologies, magnets are needed. We talk about, of course, electric vehicles, but it's far beyond that. It's about also wind turbines. It's about our defense industry. It's for various applications where we need magnets and we need electrical engines or motors.
European production of rare earth magnets is also key to the EU's attempt to increase its strategic independence from China. And that means things have to move fast. Vasileios Tsianos is the magnet company's vice president of corporate development.
Outside of China, it's the fastest a plant like this has ever been built. And the reason for that is that the community of Narva just rallied behind it. No shortcuts. They asked all the difficult questions up front.
The facility is set to produce around 2,000 tons of magnets each year, with ambitions to scale up.
If all of those magnets were to go to supply only electric vehicles, motors of electric vehicles, they would be supplying over 1 million vehicles for Europe.
Tsianos describes the production process in precise detail. First, a mix of rare earth metals, iron and boron powders is melted, then solidified into flakes and ground into powder.
Then that powder goes into alignment pressers where essentially for a few seconds you have the pressure and weight equivalent to a couple elephants stepping on that powder, while at the same time, as it's being compacted at very high force, you also apply a very strong magnetic field, and that is what aligns and magnetizes the molecules.
After that, the magnets are heat-treated again, cut to precise measurements and coated with epoxy for protection. These are the 11 stages of production in the facility. Narva and Ida-Viru County, more largely, have been the center of Estonia's oil shale industry for over a century. Oil shale, with properties similar to coal, has been phased out due to its high CO2 emissions. Estonian Prime Minister Kristen Michal views the new factory's location as an advantage.
We have like this kind of attitude everywhere all around Europe that not in my backyard, which is called the NIMBY syndrome. But given that old industrial areas or in areas with industrial traditions as Narva and eastern part of Estonia, there's lots less this kind of NIMBY attitude. So I would say that building new factories in Estonia, in the eastern part of Estonia, is probably much easier than everywhere in Europe.
But the location also carries risk. Those risks became evident on the factory's opening day in September this year, when three Russian fighter jets violated Estonian airspace for 12 minutes, just 2 hours before the ceremony began.
Yes, I was on my way to Narva, because I had a neo magnet factory opening there, so as procedures require, Prime Minister receives this type of information almost immediately. So I was informed. After that, I went to Narva.
NIO's new rare earth magnet plant in Estonia is ready to supply magnets for the motors.
The incident did not disrupt the event, as the information became public only hours later. Still, it served as a stark reminder that the factory stands just a few kilometers away from a hostile border. For Vasileios Tsianos, however, the event underscored his confidence in the factory's security.
Well, I witnessed how fast they were chased out, so I think that sends a message. Every square meter of Europe, whether Narva or downtown Paris, every square meter of the European Union and NATO is equally safe.
Either way, the factory has clear geostrategic importance, be it for the location or the magnets it produces. Joosep Värk for DW Estonia.
We have more environmental stories with a political twist coming up for you in the second half of the show. If you're listening via a partner station that leaves us here, then you will still be able to find them wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Charlie Shield, co-host of Living Planet. And I don't know about you, but right now I'm really not sure what to think about the future. One minute we hear this.
The planet experienced its hottest year ever in 2024 and at one point crossed a temperature.
And it feels, well, like we're cooked. But then we hear stuff like this.
Renewable energy has overtaken coal as the world's leading source of electricity for the first time.
And it seems like maybe, just maybe, we could be turning a corner. But fossil fuels still dominate, and the energy transition is proving anything but simple. In this new three-part mini-series from Living Planet, we're going from the deserts of Morocco to the grids of Europe, and then into legendary climate writer Bill McKibben's office, to ask why this is all so hard. The Switch, a mini-series on Living Planet, starts November 21st.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. Against the global backdrop of the climate conference in Brazil, we're looking at European environmental stories through a political lens. And I want to begin with a story absolutely designed to warm my overgrown Interrailers little heart. The announcement last week of a European Commission-backed plan for inter-European high-speed rail travel. And this is significant because whilst Europe does have some of the best high-speed rail networks in the world, for the moment, they're just that, networks with an S. Although it is true that you can do some cross-border travel on high-speed trains like France's TGV or Germany's ICE, the overwhelming number of routes stay inside national borders. That's what the European Commission wants to change, and in so doing, make rail more competitive with air travel in a bid to meet its CO2 reduction objectives. So, is a single, unified European rail system just around the corner? John Lawrenson's been looking into it for us.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome on board this TGV to Barcelona Sants. Calling at
in Paris's Gare de Lyon, one of France's famous TGVs, or train à grande vitesse high-speed trains, is about to leave the station. Destination Barcelona, a 6-hour, 48-minute trip. You can get from Paris to Boston in that time if you go by plane, and a flight to Barcelona is only an hour and 40 minutes. But with increasing environmental awareness, plus the time it takes to get between the centre of town and the airports and through security and so on, international high-speed rail trips like this one are pretty popular in Europe, to get from Amsterdam to London, for example, or Frankfurt to Strasbourg. But this, the European Commission thinks, is just the start. Most European cities are not connected by direct high-speed rail links. Take Madrid and Lisbon, for example. Less than 600 kilometres between the two, and you need to change trains three, even four times. I asked Carlos Rico, rail policy officer with the Brussels-based NGO Transport and Environment, which works on improving rail policy from a climate perspective, how the European Commission plan hopes to fix this.
So the Commission looks specifically at what the travel times could look like in 2040, once infrastructure developments are finished and we have some new connections there. But I think what's great about this plan is that it doesn't just look at big projects that will take decades to be finalized. It's really going to what's needed in the current network. So today we still have loads of barriers, from problems of bureaucracy to things like having different signaling systems in each member state. So the Commission has been working for decades on trying to expand the deployment of a single European signaling system.
Are we going to actually be laying new track as well?
Yes. In fact, the Commission calculates that 345 billion are going to be needed to reach that high-speed network that is envisioned for 2040. So that's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, over 20 billion euros a year between now and 2040. Too much to be sourced with just the Commission, says Carlos Rico. There'll need to be significant contributions from individual member states and the private sector as well. But environmentalists are hoping that the money can be taken from another source. Aoife O'Leary is the CEO of the UK-based NGO Opportunity Green, whose aim is to reduce emissions from aviation and maritime shipping.
I think it should come from the aviation sector. So the biggest aviation passenger tax in the world is currently in the UK. It's called the air passenger tax. It raises just short of £5 billion. Now, I'd have to translate that into euros, but I think it's something like 7 billion euros at the current exchange rate. That's just one country, and that's actually smaller than if you put VAT on flights. So actually, if you did this at an EU level, that 20 billion, you could raise that relatively easily. But if you focused on private jets, first class, business class especially, then you would really not be even impacting any, you know, family on their holiday once a year.
La Commission européenne a validé l'interdiction de vol intérieur français.
After banning short-haul flights inside France when a rail alternative is possible in under 2.5 hours, France, along with Spain and 4 African and Caribbean countries, launched a proposal this summer to introduce a heavy tax on business class passengers and private jet flyers. This is a potential funding stream for the EU Commission rail integration plan. The fight over who's going to foot the bill for this is still to come. According to TNE's Carlos Rico, we can expect the so-called frugal EU member countries, such as the Netherlands, to oppose upping public spending to pay for it. But on the other side, some criticise the EU plan as not ambitious enough. Mario Holzner, for example, the director of the Vienna Institute for Economic Studies.
The current plans of the Union, these are very modest. So we are speaking here about average speed of 200 kilometres per hour. I mean, there are various definitions out there what a high-speed train is, but it's rather typically 250 kilometers per hour. And I mean, if we go to China, then we find 300 kilometers per hour is achievable with actually a technology that is from the 70s.
Another barrier to people shifting in big numbers from air to rail is the price of tickets. Aoife O'Leary again.
My environmental NGO, we're about 30 people, and our travel policy is you cannot fly unless you get the permission of the CEO, me. So every time anyone in Opportunity Green wants to fly, I get an email with a breakdown of here's how long it would take on the train and here's how much it would cost. And invariably, it's hundreds of euros more to take the train rather than flying. And a lot of that is actually down to the subsidies that we give flying. They're not subsidies in the, well, there's some actually that we're actually giving direct money to, but aviation doesn't pay fuel tax. It also doesn't pay any VAT, where there is VAT on a lot of the international rail across Europe, and also potentially VAT on the electricity, which is essentially the fuel for a lot of the railways as well. So immediately you can see this kind of tax imbalance. And a lot of that stems from the energy tax directive, which is actually being negotiated at the moment at the EU level. And we are currently looking at continuing to exempt aviation from fuel tax. So basically the EU saying we will not allow any EU country to tax aviation fuel, which is the only region in the world that does that. It's completely bonkers and completely out of line with our climate objectives.
At Berlin Central Station, an ICE high-speed train pulls in. Europe's destination is an integrated high-speed rail network. But to reach one that's comprehensive, truly fast, and cheap to use compared to air travel, expect delays. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
Well, I, for one, hope that the project stays on track. Sorry about that. I actually have another pun coming up in a minute. Whilst we are looking at European attempts to reduce emissions, I have some concrete questions for these guys.
I'm Irene Dominguez. I am a policy manager at Bellona Europa. We're a climate NGO. We work in an international climate policy. And here is my colleague Marco.
Yeah, I'm Marco Sirotti. They told me I should say that I'm a doctor. So yeah, I work as embodied carbon advisor at Bellona. I have a background in cement because I did a PhD here in Brussels at the Université Libre de Bruxelles.
Dr. Sirotti is also the author of a new report, Net Zero Pathways for Cement. And at this point, I should probably issue a disclaimer because cement and concrete, they're not actually the same thing.
The difference is in what you put inside. So basically cement is the basic material, let's say, and you can use it to build something more. So it's like the example of a cake, maybe it's the flour. So you need it to make it like the substance of it, but then you can add chocolate chips, you can add vanilla flavor, whatever you want inside. And the idea is that basically you have cement paste by mixing cement powder with the water. But then if you add a bit of sand, you get mortar. And if you get aggregates of different sizes, then you get concrete.
Now, concrete and cement probably aren't the first things that people think about when they think of the EU's push to become climate neutral by 2050, but they are actually really significant, aren't they?
If you compare with a country, the emissions from the sector would be the third largest emitting country, just behind China and the US, actually. So it is a very intensive sector in terms of emissions.
The flour analogy is really interesting because when you think of our daily Western diets, at least, they're unthinkable without it. It really is something that's in everything. And the same could be said, could it not, of cement, which accounts for something like, was it 4% of the EU's carbon emissions?
You have two parts, let's say, where emissions come from during the process. One is the energy you need for that, because basically you heat the raw materials, which are limestone and clay, up to 1450 Celsius degrees, which is quite high temperature. And that usually is done burning fossil fuels. So that is already emissions that come from there. And they account for around 33%, one third of emissions. And then the rest is 66% of emissions come from the fact that limestone is a rock that you find naturally or almost everywhere in the world. And when you heat it up to more than 600, 700 degrees, it separates itself into lime, which is calcium oxide, and the rest is CO2.
So how can European cement become less carbon emitting?
I identified three main levers we can use. So the first one is we can reduce the emissions from the process itself. So we can reduce the amount of, let's say, cement, or tweak the recipe of cement by basically adding what are called supplementary cementitious materials. So basically, they are usually byproducts or waste that can be added to the cement recipe to reduce the amount of clinker, and clinker being what comes out of the factory, so the re-emitting part, to reduce that amount and have the same properties in the end or similar comparable properties. So basically, instead of using fossil fuels, we can use biomass, we can use waste, we can try to electrify the process itself. There are still, the technology is not mature yet, but there is a lot of ongoing work on that to reach high temperatures. But parts of the process can already be electrified, and with renewable energy, you can basically cancel emissions. And the third option is to do carbon capture and storage. So basically, you separate the CO2 from the fuel gas, and then you, let's say, manipulate it. You reduce the temperature, you increase the pressure, you liquefy it. And then you store it in permanent storage, usually offshore, but now there are some projects also onshore as well. Or you can use that CO2 for permanent applications that, such as mineralization. That's the main one that I can think about.
Is that technology viable at scale?
Yes, we have. There is already a project ongoing. It's called the Brevik in Norway. This started operations, I think, in June. And yeah, they're capturing a lot of CO2 and storing it permanently in geological storage. But it's very expensive. So if you have to factor into the business case as well, it can almost double the price of cement, which is considered as a cheap commodity. So you can't transport too much. And the cost is very high compared to, for instance, supplementary cementitious materials, because they are cost effective. So if you take into account the emission side and the cost part, the business case, CCS is probably the least interesting lever in terms of costs.
So no silver bullets. It's going to take a variety of solutions. And these aren't solutions, are they, that the cement industry can be expected to just implement on its own? It's going to need action at a European level. So what are the asks?
We have many.
We have many. Well, I will start with the easy part, let's say. So if you want to tweak the recipe, we have to follow standards for cement. That at the moment, we have recipe-based standards, meaning that you can choose only certain supplementary cementitious materials and also only in certain quantities without taking into account the final performance of the product. But what we ask is to switch to performance-based standards. And the fact that we don't have performance-based standards mean that innovative solutions have a more difficult time accessing the market in the EU, because they can't receive the CE marking unless through very expensive and time-consuming processes. So that's, I think, is the, let's say, easy one and the first one. And the second ask we have is to create demand for these materials, because we can ask the cement producers to decarbonize the production, but we can't ask them to sell it if there is no market for that. So for that, we refer to especially public procurement, because it accounts for, I think, 30% of the total demand for construction materials in general. We have the Energy Performance of Building Directive that asks member states to...
Each new building constructed as of 2030 will need to respect limits on whole life carbon emissions, which means all the emissions from the value chain of the building. And if you ask me, also machinery, the construction machinery is a very easy win to electrify that. And imagine what it can be like going through a construction site where you are not hearing the engines of the excavators all around you. It changes a lot as well.
I was speaking to Dr. Marco Cerotti and Irene Dominguez from Bologna. You will find a link to the Net Zero Pathways for Cement report in our show notes. And we're staying solutions focused now as we take a look at nature's original carbon capture storage units, trees. The EU's forest strategy for 2030 has the goal of planting 13 billion additional trees, and a fair few of them at least are to be found springing up in France's Val d'Oise region, about 20 kilometres from Paris, where the fledgling Maubuisson forest is sprouting on land that once stored the city's wastewater. Lisa Bryant has been investigating.
It's hard to imagine this stretch of scrubland will one day be a sanctuary for trees and wildlife. Industrial complexes and small towns dot the skyline. This is the far edge of suburban Paris. Not far away is Auvers-sur-Oise, the town where Vincent van Gogh lived his last days. But a closer look shows the ground is planted with hundreds of tree seedlings, each protected by a ring of netting. They're the product of a decades-long goal.
Bernard Tailly, le président du syndicat qui aménage cette forêt.
Bernard Tailly is a local politician. He's also the president of SMAP, the regional organization overseeing the fledgling Maubuisson Forest. We start off on foot to discover it.
We're on the first plot of land that was planted in 2019. It's about 10 hectares. It's the first test to see how it would develop.
Many of the trees are tiny, but some are already 5 or 6 meters high.
Our goal is to plant 1 million trees, but that's a symbolic figure, as we'll plant many more. When the forest is mature, there will be fewer trees, or we may need to cut some down. We plant very densely to ensure it's well developed.
As we're walking, he points to the old Haute-Bonne farm on the horizon. More than a century ago, it was part of a flourishing market garden industry. The fertilizer, Paris area sewage that was deposited here. It wasn't until the late 1990s that studies found heavy metals in the soil, and the practice was banned.
The question was, what to do with the land which was polluted? After lots of political and environmental discussions, it was decided to create a forest.
Forests can actually lock pollution in place. And Tai says this one will eventually grow to 1,350 hectares, the size of almost 2,000 European football pitches, and the biggest locally. It will welcome bikers, walkers, and horseback riders. It will link to other woods and stretch across 7 towns. The cost, about 85 million euros paid with public and private funding, is mostly for buying up private land. The next part of the visit is by car. Maubuisson is too big to cover on foot.
What?
Tai points to a hawk perched on a tall pole, part of local wildlife springing back here, and a predator of rabbits and rodents that destroy young trees. A few kilometers away, workers have just finished planting 2,000 seedlings today, including oak, whitebeam, and maple. About 100,000 are planted each year under the management of France's National Forestry Office. Maubuisson will ultimately have about 30 different, mostly deciduous species, a diversity aimed to withstand insect infestation and disease, and, experts hope, climate change.
Le premier, c'est utiliser la régénération naturelle sur place, c'est-à-dire.
Lorient Gascon is part of the Forestry Office's team. He says some tree species are local. others hardier varieties from southern France. Still others are imported. It's unclear what the climate will look like tomorrow, he says, but the idea is to give forests the best chance possible to adapt. Forests cover about 40% of Europe and a third of metropolitan France, but they're under stress, facing pollution, logging, and hotter, drier weather that's sparking more wildfires.
We're working on a 2040 target of a proposed 90% emission reduction. That is our way to climate neutrality by 2050.
Research finds Europe's forests are less able to absorb heat-trapping CO2 than a decade ago, compromising the EU's goal to zero out carbon emissions by 2050.
There is a reduction of fertility and production productivity of forests due to climate change.
Daniel Valery heads the forest program for the French chapter of the World Wildlife Fund for Nature, or WWF. He also thinks experts initially overestimated the forest capacity to absorb carbon.
We've been estimating the role of forests in our climate targets too high compared to what really the forest could deliver.
At the same time, forests will be in growing demand, not only to absorb CO2, but also as timber for green construction and other industries. Valerie says planting new forests like Maubuisson is only part of the solution. Forest management must also change.
To be adapted to short-term, planting trees that are adapted to a climate today, but also to long-term, adapted to a climate that will be available or will be there when the forest will be 50 years old or 100 years old. And that's very complex, actually, when you've got a climate which is changing.
Will that mean a steadily hotter future? Or, as some studies warn, could climate change weaken the Atlantic Ocean currents that warm Europe, leaving at least some regions sharply colder?
We just need to select the best solution with capacity to change very fast, maybe in 10 years or in 15 years, to adapt again.
So far, the Maubuisson forest has about 350 hectares of new trees. A few decades from now, Tai says, it will be a mature forest. The oldest species could live several hundred years. What this climate will be like then is anybody's guess. Lisa Bryant, DW, the Maubuisson Forest, France.
From French forests to British wine next. That's in just a minute here on Inside Europe. Most of Europe has experienced an unusually hot and dry summer this year. For many winemakers, this has been devastating. French Beaujolais, for instance, experienced its lowest yield in more than 35 years. But in the UK, the situation is the opposite. And if you ever wanted proof of climate change, then the existence of a burgeoning British wine industry has to be it. Lars Bavanga reports from the northwest of England.
So you can see this one has about four branches coming out, right?
Julian Ian is taking me on a tour of the Cardon Park vineyard just south of Liverpool. It's mid-October and normally this is when the grape harvest should be in full swing. But this year, the harvest came a full 3 weeks early.
This is Sauvignon Blanc. You can try a bit if you want.
Yeah, okay. There's some leftover from the harvest.
That's very nice.
For Julian and Cardon Park, a hot, dry summer and exceptionally early harvest have been a boon, and they expect the resulting wines will be particularly good. But that's not the case further south in Europe.
It feels like we are on the boom or growing amazing grapes and have a nice production, a good production in the UK. But if we're thinking how is the climate changing, affecting the old world, I wouldn't be that happy because 2 degrees or 4 degrees more, especially on the coast of Spain or Portugal or France, that could have negative impact into their grapes that they are growing at the moment. 2 degrees more and their crops, it could be overripe.
Industry insiders like Julian say that only 20 years ago, most Europeans would balk at the idea of British wine. But climate change and increasingly skilled vintners have changed all that, according to Nicola Bates. She's the CEO of Wine GB, the main trade association for UK winemakers.
Our winemakers probably have the biggest challenges in the world. In a cool climate growing area, every year is very different when it comes to the weather. So they are constantly challenged and have to innovate and have to work it through. So our producers and winemakers and vineyard workers are all extremely experienced now.
Along with increased quality and a growing market for British wine, the number of vineyards here has risen from a few hundred some 20 years ago to more than 1,100 today, from the very south all the way up to Scotland.
We are seeing more and more people looking at the opportunity of wine. As the climate changes, there is more likelihood that people will jump on the opportunity. And I suspect we'll just see more of our country moved over to vineyards and that being more of the part of our way of life.
I believe we should have Pinot Noir to our right here. This is about 3.5 acres. We've got 5,700 vines.
Tim Sleep and his family are among those who have taken the chance and they established their own vineyard only last year.
We bought this farm, originally never planning a vineyard, and then we kind of went on this journey of figuring out that we can. And not only can we do it and just make actually plant vines, but we can actually make really quite good wine.
Dark Peak Wines is nestled on sloping hills below an Anglican church dating from the 14th century with views over Manchester in the distance. They are Manchester's first vineyard.
The idea of starting a vineyard in this part of the world would appear to many as quite unusual.
Bold
and unusual. How important has it been that British vineyards are actually quite established now? How much help has it been for you that people have gone the road before you, say?
Massively. I think pretty much every vineyard I have called up, if I'd said, oh, can I come around and have a look or learn a little bit more about what you're doing, everyone has been so welcoming. I think there is this momentum within the industry. People see other people as supporting the wave and the positivity around what English wine is becoming.
This is 100% Sauvignon Blanc. Right, the grape, it has a higher acidity.
Back at Carden Park Vineyard near Liverpool, Julian Ian lets me taste their latest products, a rosé and a sparkling white, which, to my relatively untrained palate, could easily compete with mainland European wines. Perhaps not surprisingly, Julian too is optimistic about the future of British wine.
I will say that even now, though this year and the previous year, we have a very good quality of sparkling that they are competing against their French champagne or any sparkling that it comes from Europe. So, yes, I do see British wines going out on the market, especially on the European market.
Lars Bravanger, DW, at the Carden Park Vineyard.
There will be more stories of climate adaptation and resistance next week. For now, though, just time for me to remind you of our email address, insideeurope@dw.com, and to tell you that this programme was produced by Laura Kaberka and me, Kate Laycock. Our sound engineers were Jürgen Kuhn, Ilias Katsamakis and Lucy Krupp. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.